The following video contains explicit sexual details from a Jeffrey Epstein survivor. Because of YouTube's guidelines, I've had to censor and edit this video heavily. You can watch the uncensored, full-length version of this video at softwhiteunderbelly.com. I'm proud to have a platform where these women can share their stories and we can all learn from them. I'll be posting Jeffrey Epstein survivor stories each Saturday for the next month or two. And now for the censored version of this video. All right, Haley. Haley, where'd you grow up? Where are you from originally?
Miami, Florida. I grew up in Miami, Florida, North Dade.
Tell me about your family.
Ooh, I had two siblings, both older sisters. My father was a homicide and robbery detective. He joined the force in the 80s when the cocaine cowboys were at its peak. So I had a lot of interesting stories growing up with my dad. My mom was in the banking industry, and then she quit to enter hospitality bartending. And we were, for the most part, well-adjusted children, big family, big holiday celebrations. We were into equestrian. We did dance, gymnastics, swim team. We were busy. My parents kept us busy for the most part.
Sounds like a solid family.
You would think. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was there were some dark parts too though. You know, I had two older siblings and watching my older sister, I think she was 14, I think I was right around 8, and my parents were having behavioral issues with her. She was my half sister. I didn't find that out until I was 18. And there were behavioral issues with her growing up, acting out when she was 14, not coming home, sneaking through the window. And I remember as a child, I was in elementary school. I think I was right around 8 or 9. And I would go to my friend's house down the street in Miami, and I would play with her after school or, you know, go over for dinner. And her brother would walk me home at night to my house. I was never allowed to walk home alone. And my sister's belongings and her clothes would be scattered all over our front yard with garbage bags. And that's when I learned that she was forced to go live with my grandmother because she just – my parents could not get her under control. There was just a lot of issues, and I would be getting up for school in the morning with my middle sister, who I shared the same school with. And my mom and my 14-year-old sister, half-sister, would be in the bathroom fist fighting, throwing down because she was making us late for school or she wasn't getting ready on time. And that's, I think, where my childhood trauma started, watching that kind of violence at 8 years old, 9 years old, with your mom and your sister. I mean, it's maybe not horrifying in the moment, but when you grow up and become your own mom and you become a mother, it's horrifying. It changes your perspective a little bit on family. Mm-hmm. And then my dad, my dad being a homicide and robbery detective, that was he was never home. He was always on call. A lot of birthday parties and social events that he would miss out, which, you know, as a child, you don't understand. But again, when you become an adult, you start to understand. You have bills to pay. You have children to feed. You have money that you need to make, a mortgage to pay. So I never had resentment. As I got older, I understood that concept. But we moved out of Miami due to the fact that my father was running into people that he was putting in jail. And then our house got broken into. That was when my father and mother decided that we needed to move and that he could no longer be a police officer in Miami with us in the same area, knowing that he's running into these perpetrators. And I'm talking like dirty cartel, like bad people. And then our house got broken into. So we moved and we had a house built in Loxahatchee, which is out west in West Palm Beach, Royal Palm Beach area. I was 13, 12 or 13 when we moved. Rode equestrian. But there was such a disconnect for me when I moved, because going from Miami, where all my friends were biracial, different economic status, different races intertwined, and then coming to Loxahatchee, where when I went to high school, I got made fun of a lot because I didn't look like a white girl. I had black curly hair. I looked Italian. I looked European. And I got teased a lot for the way I looked. And high school was hard. And I had my two older sisters. And high school wasn't good for me. It was where a lot of my sexual abuse started. I had a friend in middle school and in high school. And that was the first time I was sexually assaulted. I would go over to her house to sleep over. And her 20-year-old brother would come in and wake me up at night. And when you're 13, you don't really understand the full... You think it's a crush. You know, oh, I'm 13, I have a crush on my friend's brother. And the next thing you know, he wants to have sex with you. Or he wants to hook up with you. You're 13, you know? And we never, you know, it never got to that length. And then it was to the point where I would sleep over and she would have to lock her door. And her mom was buying us alcohol. And when we would come to her house, her brothers would give us weed. So it was like the party house. I would go over there and we would have alcohol. We would have marijuana. You know, it was not a lot of guidance in her house. And eventually I stopped sleeping over. It just got really uncomfortable and awkward. My freshman year of high school, my sophomore year of high school, I had pretty good grades. You know, I was pretty solid in what I wanted to do with life. And I was an equestrian rider. I competed. I had a thoroughbred and a quarter horse. And my dad and I were training my quarter horse and breaking her in together. It was a father-daughter probably one of the happiest memories of my dad. And then that all changed because I was hanging out with people I shouldn't be hanging out with. You know, having older siblings, sometimes you run with an older crowd. And we were going to clubs at 15, you know, the girls that I went to school with that I considered friends. We were all going to nightclubs. We were all drinking. We were getting in. And at 15, I was at a friend's house. Her aunt was leaving for the weekend and we had to stay with, at her house to watch the horses and take care of the barn and the house. And we went out that night and, we ended up having people come back to the house and I was raped. And it happened just like that. One minute I was in the pool with my girlfriend and two guys. Next thing I couldn't stand up. I was having difficulties in the bathroom putting, like, changing my clothes. And then one of the guys walked me into a bedroom and said, I think you need to sit down. And at that point I had only had two shots of Bacardi. I wasn't aware of what was going on. And I ended up in the bedroom. And he was on top of me, this 22-year-old man that I did not even find attractive. I didn't even like. And I started feeling pressure in that area. And I started crying and I told him that it hurt. And I asked him to stop. And he looked at me and said, let me just get my nut and be over quick. And I just remember laying in the bed and I turned my head to the to the left. And I just looked at the door and I just started crying.
My dad was giving me a hard time about not watching the news enough, so naturally I gave him a hard time right back. I told him most of what we're shown is designed to alarm us, not inform us. And that's why I asked Ground News to sponsor my channel. Ground News is an app and website that helps you form your own opinions by showing you every article published on any story worldwide. My favorite part is how it breaks down each news source's political bias, reliability, and even ownership, so you can actually see where your information is coming from. Let me show you how it works. Here's a story about the Palisades fires in Los Angeles. Ground News shows that 13 outlets covered it, most leaning slightly right. You can instantly see who owns these outlets, how reliable they are, and how differently they frame the same event. Some headlines focus on firefighter decisions, others on weather and risk. Same story told through two very different lenses. I also like their blind spot feed. It highlights stories that are covered heavily by one side but ignored by the other. It's a simple way to step outside your own echo chamber. So if you're tired of being told what to think, check them out at ground.news/SWU. You'll get 40% off their Vantage plan, and by subscribing or even gifting it to someone, you're supporting independent thinking and this channel directly. Again, that's ground.news/SWU. Thank you for watching.
I don't even think we were fully finished, and his friend walked in. And his friend started laughing at me. Because I was a... And he ripped me, so I was bleeding. And that was my first experience with a man ever. I woke up the next morning extremely sore. I obviously was aware of what happened. I just wasn't aware of the details. So I called him that morning and asked him if, you know, did you at least wear, like, did you at least have enough decency to wear? And he laughed at me and asked me if I wanted a relationship with him. And that was the first experience I ever had with a man, pretty much. I was everything. It ruined everything for me. And about 6 months later, I was heavy into drugs at that point. I was doing cocaine, a lot of Xanax. I was drinking a lot. And I was out of control because I had all this trauma, all these things that were happening around me and to me, and I didn't know what to do with it. And I in my household, we didn't talk about things like that. It was very taboo. We don't discuss things like that. It was very much sweeping everything under the rug and pretending like everything was fine. I came home one night from, like, a binge. I think I was gone for 2 or 3 days. And my mom and dad had been sitting at the dining room table, and they called me over, and my sisters were out of the house. And they sat me down and told me, like, you're living a fast life. The direction of your life is not good. And if you don't stop, something horrific is going to happen to you. And I just remember saying to my parents, like, it already did. And I fucking hate you guys for it. And there were some things that happened after that with my parents. My dad was very upset. He felt very disrespected. But they put me in therapy. Never asked me what happened. They just put me in therapy. And I was crazy for a long time. You know, I know this is confusing. I was in therapy while being abused by Jeffrey. Yeah, if you can believe that. And my therapist had told my mom, your daughter is displaying severe signs of sexual abuse and assault. But HIPAA, the way it works is because I was her patient, there was only so much information she could give, even though she was my parent. So nobody knew what I was going through or to the degree or magnitude of what was happening to me because I wasn't opening up. I was scared. And when I met Jeffrey, I thought he would make it all go away. And I met Jeffrey when I was 16. I had just turned 16 years old. I was recruited at the Canopy, which was a beach resort on Singer Island, by a classmate. She was the same age as me, and she recruited me and gave me his number. And within that week, I picked her up. I picked up Tony Figueroa, who was an adult male, and all three of us drove together to Jeffrey's mansion, and they told me it would just be a massage, an easy $200, and that's not what took place upstairs. I was brought upstairs, and Jeffrey came out in a white bath towel, and he wasn't wearing anything else, just the white bath towel, and there was a massage table set up. And it was like a room within a room. So it was the master bedroom, and then you would walk into the bathroom, but it wasn't just a bathroom. It was a steam room, a sauna, a shower. It was like a room within a room. And when Jeffrey came out in his towel, it started off pretty innocent. You know, I had my clothes on. He was laying on his stomach with the towel on, so I was just rubbing his back. And he flipped over and it became something completely different. And he grabbed me on the backside so firmly that it like pushed me into the table to get closer to him. And at this point, he had asked me to take off my skirt and my shirt. So I was just in my And that's when he started to touch me and places and he brought out sex toys, and I was completely uncomfortable with that. And the look on his face of disappointment, it was like being bullied or being berated because you didn't want to do the drugs. And in that hour, I was abused for that entire hour. And then he forced me to do things to him as he and finished himself. And in that room, he looked at me and said, "Well, you're going to come back when I call you, or you're going to bring a friend." And he gave me that ultimatum. And that's what it was. And as a 16-year-old, you can imagine how terrifying that must be for anybody after already going through a horrific sexual assault. I made a decision out of survival, and I stand by that choice. Do I regret it? Yes. Do I wish that I could have been an adult in that moment? Do I wish that I could have had somebody guide me? Do I wish that somebody would have came in and ran and opened that door and grabbed me? Absolutely. But all I had was me. I had to make a decision.
You were 16.
I was 16. I wanted to get out. And I was in his orbit for 2 years after that. And it was horrifying. When I turned 18, after being abused by Jeffrey for 2 years, I decided that it was time that I move. Because legally at 18, you can move. You have that option. So when I turned 18 years old, I decided to move to Orlando, Florida. So shortly after Jeffrey, I moved. And I tried to start a new life. And I tried to start a new chapter.
How often were you seeing Jeffrey?
I think I went to his house maybe between 24 and 35 times through those 2 years. So maybe once a month. You know what I mean? It wasn't, once or twice a month. I wasn't as frequent as most people think I was. And I brought, I think, 8 to 10 girls. But I went to his house more than once with those girls. So I was a recurring customer, I guess, or a victim, I guess you could say. But the girls had come with me more than once. And when you did something horrific, or if you brought someone to Jeffrey that he didn't like, you would know about it because he would scold you for it. And then he would say to you, "I told you the younger the better. Do not bring me this girl anymore." don't ever bring her back to my house. I had him say that to me 3 times. He reprimanded me. And I didn't like the way it made me feel. I didn't like being in his presence. I just wanted out of West Palm. So I moved. And I moved to Orlando, Florida. I was an exotic dancer for quite some time, a couple years. I fell in love. I was 19 and I met somebody. And it was the first time in my life that a man didn't force me to have sex. It was the first time a man didn't expect me to have sex. It was literally a man who wanted nothing from me but just to be in my presence. And he was murdered in 2006. And that was probably one of the most horrific experiences of my life. To have such bad experiences with men and then to meet somebody that instead of wanting to take from you, they just wanted to be there for you. And to have that kind of friendship and to be able to sit in silence with a man and for him to understand what you've been through without questioning you, without asking you, but to just be there. It was something I had never experienced before in my life with anybody of the opposite sex. So I took his death extremely hard. But it was a sobering moment for me. It was a very sobering moment for me because at that point I decided to get off drugs and to try to clean up my act, to like actually make a solid attempt at like, okay, girl, you got this. Like, we can do this. We have to get ourselves together. And that night he was murdered. My mom and my aunt came and picked me up. And it changed my life forever because that same week, everything hit the press with Jeffrey Epstein. And my name was tarnished and dragged through the mud. And so when I say I lost everything, I lost everything. And everyone. I lost my family that day. I lost my boy. I lost a lot. But looking back in hindsight, when you become an adult, I realized that there was nothing wrong with me. I wasn't the problem. I just needed somebody to sit down and listen and hear me and to see me and to believe me. I was called crazy. I was called a lot of things when I came out about Jeffrey, and I was not lying. I was not crazy at all. And it's a very re-traumatizing thing to go through when you're a child trying to balance life, school, trauma. And then, you know, by the time I graduated high school, I think I was 18, there was nobody left in my house. My sisters had been moved out. So it was just me. There was nobody to really look after me or protect me until my mom, I think at 16 or 17, my mom gave up her job to be stay at home. But it was too late. I had already been trafficked. And people think that trafficking means that you're sitting in a cell block or you're sitting in a garage, like, you know, with handcuffs on and you're not allowed to go anywhere and you don't see daylight. And it's such a huge misconception of what trafficking is. And fast forward to bringing us today and seeing how everything has moved through the media and has been outed so publicly, you know, I think people, including the public, often forget that while everybody's reading these files and gossiping about the girls instead of trying to find justice for the girls, we're seeing this in real time, the same time that everybody else is seeing this and reading this material. We did not get a heads up. We got nothing. So it's re-traumatizing even more. I never in my wildest life imagined that there would be these kinds of heinous crimes or material in these files. When I stood at the Capitol and I advocated to release files and that I wanted to be transparent because that is what's best for America, for the people, for the public, for everybody. It needs to be out there so we can move past it. What I wasn't expecting was children being sacrificed or the adults that were also contributing to the abuse of minor children. I mean, how do you recover from that? How does America recover from that? You can't fix it. It's out there. And I think in retrospect, if we knew that this is the kind of salacious material that was in the files, maybe decisions would have been slightly differently in how we handled it. But because Epstein is the first huge public pedophile that has been so public, nobody knew how to handle us, the victims. Nobody knew how to cope or how to help us. This was a learning curve for everybody, for the victims, the police department, the government. And it's been horrendous. It's been ugly. It's been re-traumatizing. And when you open those files and you're seeing my name pop up or the names of other girls that have also too been out, we're real people. We're real people with real trauma. This isn't just a Netflix documentary. This was our life that we lived as children. And I can't fathom staying quiet or staying silent. And I can't understand how a government can sit back for whatever reason, whether it's CIA intelligence or for whatever reason. Why are we sacrificing the children of America and around the world for our government affairs to keep everybody in line? Why is that a thing? That should never be a thing, whether it's for government, whether it's for experiments, nothing. You never sacrifice children. That's not what we stand for as human beings. And seeing all of this unfold has been devastating. But we lived it and we survived it. And the children in all of this that came from broken homes, that came from poverty, that came from maybe parents that had drug addiction. We are the outcome of that. We are what is left of Epstein. And in some capacity, when you take those files and you take the fragments that you received, nobody has been exonerated. Nobody should be getting off. Everybody should be investigated. I was a 16-year-old victim that was recruited and brought into this. And yet in Florida, during the 2009 investigation, I was brought in for a grand jury. I had to testify in front of a grand jury. Because the world thought I was a co-conspirator. So when I did this and I went in front of the grand jury, I was not indicted because I'm not a co-conspirator, I'm a victim. And that was proven in the system, that was proven in courts. That's my testimony. My testimony of all the abuse and trauma that Jeffrey has put me through. But why? Why was no one else brought in for a grand jury? There were adults that were actively abusing us. There were co-conspirators that were actively abusing us. Nobody had to go to that length to prove they're innocent, but the child in all of this. It always comes back to the house you grew up in, the home that you were raised in. In 2023, I believe, I'm a full-grown adult. And I was physically attacked by my sister. And it's public record. And the words will never not resonate with me when things like, I wish you would have gotten, I wish you were dead, the things that come out of people's mouths because they can't understand the trauma, they can't understand the situation. The parents out there that have children that want to protect the children, they have to start educating themselves and getting in front of this and having honest conversations. We all, unfortunately, the abuse of our story in Florida with the children is that we were to bring other friends into this trafficking ring. That was the abuse. That was something that in 2023, when DeSantis had the press conference in Florida, he made all the files on a state level public. And the first thing the judge said was, this is the most heinous crimes I have seen against children. And the thing with Jeffrey Epstein, and I will never forget hearing this on Tucker Carlson. He was talking about what is the attraction to 14 and 15 year old girls with braces and not fully developed. And he said, Jeffrey wanted to destroy the innocence out of children. It was a power that he wanted from children. And when you think about that, there is nothing more sinister than somebody that wants to break down a child for their own personal gain. But looking back on everything and the way that this whole case has been handled in Florida with all of the corruption, we may have some of the files, but the damage has been done to the credibility of the government. The damage has been done to the credibility and integrity of the entire case. Because no matter what documents now are released, it's already been proven that there has been damage done to those documents. So at what point as a nation do we stand up and do we say to each other, this is non-political? This is about the direction of our country and the direction that our government is taking us in. It's not a good direction. When you start gambling and sacrificing the children that you're supposed to be protecting, it stops becoming a safe place. And without children, without us protecting children, whether our own or others, where does the future lie? We're just creating more damaged people and then making it impossible for them to get therapy? It's a vicious cycle, it sounds like. But this story of Jeffrey Epstein is not just about pedophilia. This is about a two-tiered mechanical system designed by man in power to hold that power, to sustain that power over the constituents that he depends on, the government depends on. And we as a nation need to understand that we put these people in power and we have the power to take that away from them. And unfortunately, with the children in this case and with the young women in this case, we have all been so traumatized, not just with our home lives, but with our own country and our own government. So release the files, unredacted, and let every person in this country and around the world see how far we've gone away from God. It's dangerous.
It's insane that we're accepting that the files were released, but only some of them, and parts are blocked out, and it's like, how is that acceptable?
It's not acceptable, and they're breaking the law by their own admission into signing in the bill for the Transparency Act that Thomas Massie and Ro Khanna passed. And the problem that we're having is there's people in power that are not being held accountable from the top. And until we hold them accountable, until we hold them responsible and force them to come in and testify and to have open investigations to decide who is involved and who is not, it will never be anything more than a story about a billionaire pedophile who had an island. And it seems as though if we don't come together and try to make changes for our country, this is going to be a repeat pattern. It's going to happen again. And the fact that they're redacting all of these perpetrators but not redacting the victims, that is another assault on not just the victims of Jeffrey Epstein. That is a war, an act of war on every survivor, every child, woman, and man that have come forward to talk about their own abuse. You can't intimidate us, not with your smear campaigns, not with your threats, not with your lack of empathy. This will come out. It may take 10 years. It may take another 20 years. We don't know. And like I said, with the credibility of this entire investigation and the entire case starting from 2009 back in Florida, we may never get the full truth because it's already been compromised. And that is the reality.
Yeah, it's really embarrassing.
For our country, absolutely. I take a look at Europe, my Northern Europe. I love my Nordic countries up there. I've done a lot of media with them and I've had a lot of conversations. The world is laughing at us. We are ran by a pedophile. We're run by pedophiles. And there's no way you will ever convince me that a group of 40 young girls could come forward with the same story. And that the country actually believes that we were fabricated or that we were a Democrat hoax. You can't fake that kind of abuse. It doesn't happen.
What do you think people misunderstand about the survivors?
Oh, there's a lot. I don't even know where to unpack. One thing that I feel like nobody ever touches on this, and I really need people to understand this, to understand the scope and the magnitude. Not everybody was trafficked. A lot of the girls in Florida were sexually abused by Jeffrey. Some were trafficked. Majority were not. New Mexico, that we don't talk enough about. I would like to know more about New Mexico, but from my understanding, there's been a lot of experiments and a lot more dark sacrifices and horrific crimes against humanity that needs to be investigated. But then you see that they just stop, that the DOJ is demanding them to stop the investigations, and it's like, here we are again, met with more resistance, and I think the writing's on the wall. I mean, there's only one reason why somebody wouldn't want to investigate possible crimes against children at a ranch. And, you know, that's huge. And I think that speaks volumes. And other countries look at that like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? And it is embarrassing. But it's interesting that geographically, when you look at Florida, New York, and New Mexico, all the abuse was different. The older girls that were models, mostly from my knowledge, were more trafficked out to other individuals and corporations. And yet the children in Florida, majority of us, were kept for Jeffrey. And then New Mexico has kind of been the silent factor in all this, hasn't it? Until recently with the files. And so that's something that the public needs to understand, is that the abuse was different geographically. And I know that may not make a lot of sense to a lot of people. It doesn't make sense with me. But unfortunately, Jeffrey's not – well, I don't want to say unfortunately. I guess it's fortunate that he's not here, but it's also unfortunate because we have so many questions that we would like to have answers to. But also, too, you know, with the public is I understand if you've never been trafficked, if you've never been sexually exploited or abused, or you've never gone through that sort of trauma, it is understand – it's very hard to understand, and I get that. But get educated. Please educate yourselves. Go talk to people that run coalitions, nonprofits. Research what trafficking is to its core and what exploitation is. You know, I hear a lot of people say, it would never happen to me. You know, that is the first person it happens to, unfortunately, is the person that is so arrogant and ignorant to think it would never touch them. This was in the back. This was in our backyard. Jeffrey was doing this in our backyard. He did it while we were at school. You know, it's a very difficult thing to grasp.
Do you see hope for the situation in the future here?
I'm hopeful because of Thomas Massey and Ro Khanna and their diligence and just their remarkable tenacity. It's incredible to watch. They're not letting this go. And they give me a lot of hope for America in general, and especially for the Epstein files to be released. And it's incredible to watch how this, in the very beginning, seemed to be a partisan issue. But as we're seeing, it's becoming more non-bipartisan as the time is going and more documents are being released. And now you have more Republicans like Mace and Luna that are coming out saying, oh, no, 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 no. We want this released. We want the files out. This needs to be exposed. So I do see a lot more people showing interest and genuine concern for what's in those files. But until those people in the files are brought in front of a grand jury or brought in for questioning and investigations are opened up, I'm going to remain calm and not too over the top with my hope. I'm going to try to be neutral and positive, but realistic.
It's laughable and embarrassing that it's okay to edit or redact these files and release them that way.
It's disgusting.
It's disgusting.
And it's deliberate. And that's the part we need to start talking
okay,
about.
Okay, here's your files, but we're taking out the important parts.
So ironically that you're bringing that up, because I've been probably one of the only survivors that have been very vocal on wanting transparency, to the point of where I've been like, don't redact my name. I don't care. I don't care if it's unredacted. I don't care if it's redacted. I don't give a crap.
Everyone's name seemed to be out there anyway.
Well, and that was kind of like, well, there was two reasons for that. My first reason was I've never been protected. Why would you do it now? My name's been public for 23 years. There's no new information on me in that file.
Well, the names they're editing out are really the people in power.
That's the problem we're having, is when I said I didn't care if my name was redacted or not, that was not to signal that we want to redact the perpetrators. And, you know, it's really something to see when Thomas Massey has to get on the phone with the DOJ and say, why is this name redacted? Les Wexner redacted? Really? Are you kidding me? That man was the staple in Jeffrey's life that was honestly, this would never have been possible without him. And again, I didn't need the files to know that. The files were to prove to America. I've been knowing that. I don't know if America has dabbled into a Les Wexner on a deeper scope. Go look at Abercrombie and Fitch. Look at the boys they trafficked through the modeling agencies. This is why it's so huge and why the files need to come out. Is because this is not just about girls that are underage and not just about children. There are boys in that file. There are boys that are now grown men in that file that have never seen a day in court, that have been shamed into silence because of the stipulation and the horrific conversation circulating homophobia now. And they're scared to come forward, a lot of them. It's like, at what point do we sit back and say, These are the most heinous, egregious crimes against children and men and women that I have ever seen. And it is absolutely unacceptable for any government official to block the perpetrators in this. Ehud Barak. Oh, don't even get me started on him. I don't dig into the names very much because I wasn't trafficked. It wasn't my experience. But when I've heard stories about Virginia's book and Ehud Barak came up and he was the prime minister, and I'm going to say his name until I'm blue in the face because I don't think there is a more heinous perpetrator in that whole file than Ehud. Not only did he rape these girls and traffic these girls, he physically abused them. What are we doing as a nation? Are we not upset enough? Are we not angry enough? At what point do we take the side of the children? And do we say we have to go to war? It's been the children in all of this that have been going to war and battling things, not just externally, but internally. It's not just the sexual abuse with Jeffrey. It's the trafficking. It's the smear campaigns. It's the threats. There are so many of us that are still in complete fear because even though Jeffrey's dead, what about his accomplices? And then you have Ghislaine Maxwell. And I've been very outspoken about this with the Democrat female caucus. And I've said this in Congress. Why is she not back in prison? Why haven't we done that yet? You saw the files. America's seen the files. We know that she is more than a co-conspirator. She is a pedophile. She partook in all of this abuse. She aided and abetted Jeffrey's crimes. She partook in the crimes. And honestly, in my opinion, she was more so of the mastermind. And her abuse was just as horrific as Jeffrey's, if not worse. And yet she is in a summer camp. And I have been very vocal about why aren't we investigating who made that deal? Who made that deal? Where did that come from? Trump and his entire administration, you need to come in. Because as least you can do is explain why you're in the files and why she got a deal. Bring Todd Blanche in. You can't talk me into believing that Todd Blanche went to talk to Ghislaine alone and there wasn't a deal that was made. There have been deals that have been made since the very first day. How many children are you going to bargain until you do the right thing? At what cost? How many more survivors have to die? How many more of us do we have to take our own life for you guys to see this is serious for us? Some of us are drowning in our own shit, hoping that someone throws us a goddamn life preserver and everybody, including the adults. Back then in 2004, when we were being abused all the way up until 2026, are just sitting back and watching. What are we waiting for? What are we waiting for? I applaud Thomas Massey. I applaud Rokana. I could be 60 before I see anybody go to jail for what was done to me or to the other girls. That is the reality of this. And every day that we wake up fighting this, people look at us and they say, "You're resilient, you're strong. You're courageous." And I look in the mirror every day and all I see is a mother. An overprotective mother who has seen evils in this world that has consumed her. That has taken away stability, trust. It's taken away everything. Everything that women are compiled of. Love, nurturing. Those things don't get talked enough about in trauma. But when you've endured things like that, it makes the way you interact with other people very difficult. showing affection, trusting people, being able to go to work. I have a full-time job and I have to work through all of this. You know, those things can be complicated. Those are obstacles that we on a daily basis have to go through. So at the end of all of this, regardless of how long it takes, there's already been collateral damage. The damage has already been done. You can't undo it. You can't fix it. The only thing that can even equate at this point is arresting and investigating every single co-conspirator and perpetrator on that list. That is the only thing that's left to do. And here we are.
It looks like they're all going to just walk away unscathed while you guys, all the victims, are dealing with death threats and all the crap you guys have to go through.
You know, I do believe that's true, and it's a reality that I try to steer from because I want to be hopeful. I want to wake up tomorrow and I want to love my life. And I want to believe that there will be an end to this. But, you know, unfortunately, I've also had to be realistic. And what the ending looks like in my mind versus what the ending is going to look like in reality, I have to understand those are two separate things. They're very different. And I have heard a lot of representatives say that, unfortunately, they might be shamed, they might be embarrassed, they might lose their job. And I'm okay with that. I've come to accept that that may be what is all that is done. But at least the victims don't have to keep carrying that shame and that burden anymore. Let the perpetrators, let the co-conspirators, let them carry that. The children shouldn't have to anymore. It's not our burden. The adults knew. All the adults knew what was going on. The police knew. The FBI knew. Our government knew. So when you say about the survivors, when the public says or makes comments, well, you could have just left. Oh, yeah? The cops could have taken our complaints a little more seriously and followed up. The FBI could have taken our complaints a little more seriously and actually investigated and did their damn job. The DOJ could actually feel some remorse and guilt about the way they've handled this document and file release and actually decide to make a change today and do the right thing for survivors, for the children in this. The adults are still failing. The country's failing. And until we start having those honest conversations, it won't change.
All right. Haley, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on all of this and telling your story.
Thank you.
I hope things get better for everyone, for the country.
I'm praying. It's hard to read those files and not be affected. You know, like as a country, like we all need therapy now after reading those files, if you want to be honest.
But as a survivor, it's got to be so difficult to know that nothing is really being done.
It is. It's terrifying because I look at my girl, my daughter, and she's 12. And I look at her every day and I'm like, God, I did not go through what I went through for her to go through it too. I am doing the best I can co-parenting with my ex-husband to make sure that I have a child that's very grounded and assertive and very well aware of the nature of what's out there without terrifying her, without pulling that light from her. That's hard to do as a parent. That's really hard to do. But when you see all these other countries opening investigations, countries that I went to, that I've done media with, are doing more for their constituents than my own government, it might take the United Nations to get involved. I don't know. I don't know what it's going to take for people to wake up and say, those conspiracy theories that we were all laughing about 10 years ago, saying how crazy this can't be true, never in my wildest dreams did I think that I would be at the center of it all, or a part of it, or attached to it. And I'm sure the other girls feel the same way. Jeffrey is a stain on all of our lives, including the government. That's blood on their hands. They have to make it right. And there are good people that are trying, but we need power, and there's power in numbers. So more people that join this fight, the better the result, the better the conclusion, and that's what we need.
All right. Haley, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.